We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good afternoon. This is Keeping the Faith. Steve is out of town on a choir tour, so he'll be gone today, and I'm filling in. This is Don Nolan. I'm Professor Emeritus of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Parkland, and we have a very interesting guest today. His name is Dan Guillory, Professor Guillory, who is Professor of English, Professor Emeritus of English at Millikan University, and he's here to talk to us about a brand new book on Lincoln, which is quite an interesting read. Professor Guillory, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I understand you're a bit of a veteran. You've been on this program before.
Yes, on this one once before, and also some of the other programs, much shorter ones.
As I recall, you did one with Steve on your prior book, The Lincoln Poems?
Yes, I did.
Is that right?
Yes, and that was very enjoyable.
And I think, as we were talking before, you've actually been here four times.
Yes.
Other programs or yes. On this one?
Yeah, the Noonday program.
The Noonday program. Yeah. Well, so you're a veteran of WILL.
More or less.
All right. And you're also a native of Central Illinois? Yes?
No. Native of Louisiana.
A lover of Central Illinois, yeah. Native of Louisiana.
Yeah. Although I've lived in Central Illinois longer than any other place. So.
Right. Well, we're going to talk today about Professor Guillory's new book, just out how many weeks now?
Oh, about 3 weeks.
3 weeks. Entitled People and Places in the Land of Lincoln. He's written a cultural guide for curious and literate tourists. Would that be
a rough, fair sketch? A nice description.
And he has an awful lot of stories to tell us about Lincoln and also about the physical and environmental and Cuisinary and all of so much of what it would be like to be alive during Lincoln's time here in Central Illinois, right?
All right. What people ate, how they dressed, so, what they used for money, so forth.
We hope you join in on the discussion. If you'd like to call in, this is a call-in show. Our number is 333-9455. That's our local number. You can also call an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455, if you'd like to ask a question of Professor Guillory about his new book, People and Places in the Land of Lincoln. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. You have a name which you yourself told me earlier is a Cajun name, and you're from Louisiana.
Yes.
What's your stock, as we say?
Well, my father was in the service. I was actually born in Texas on an Army base. I got exposed to a lot of languages early on. It was a prisoner of war camp for honors German officer prisoners.
In Texas.
So I like to tell people that by the time I was 3 years old, I had been exposed to four languages, standard English, Texan, which I regard as a separate language.
It is, definitely. Cajun
French, and a little kitchen German. So, we moved back to Louisiana after the war. And actually, my father stayed in the service, and we lived in New Orleans proper and then moved up the suburbs. So, but I basically think of New Orleans as home and hit the prairie. It's daunting. If you've grown up here and you live here, you don't think of it as a wide open space or a place where you might get agoraphobia from all this openness. But particularly in Lincoln's day, people came and they didn't want to settle on the prairie. They all settled along the river courses because they wanted to be around trees. Mm-hmm. And people were, of course, legitimately frightened of prairie fires, malaria, and other problems with the prairie, to say nothing of trying to break up that prairie sod with this network of roots and grasses. So I did experience some of that, but at the same time, I think I fell in love with the sunsets. And as one of my friends told me, you're going to actually have four seasons here, because I was used to basically having one pretty continuous season, a few little interruptions.
But in New Orleans?
Yes. Yeah? Yes. Yeah.
So the sea, you never experienced winter down there, right?
Not really. Yeah, not really. It I remember when I was in eighth grade, it snowed, and there were all sorts of car wrecks. It wasn't much of a snow, and it was gone the next day.
I grew up in Texas, and my wife's family is from San Antonio. And,
okay, same.
She describes the the great half-inch snow of 1970-something or another. Well, you wrote the Lincoln Poems, which was finished in 2008, right? Mm-hmm. And your book that followed on is the one we're talking about today, People and Places in the Land of Lincoln. And that's just out a few weeks ago. I think I heard you describe People and Places as evolving out of or developing from the Lincoln Poems. Is that correct?
Well, yes, and in a very specific way. The Lincoln Poems, I was just very flattered. It was one of 21 books that was picked to be part of the Lincoln celebration on Lincoln's birthday in 2009.
The bicentennial.
Yes, mm-hmm. The bicentennial celebration. And, of course, it ended with President Obama visiting that evening and so forth. It was, yes, and it was quite an event. But there were people there from all over the world. I met a gentleman from Perth, Australia.
You mentioned that.
Yeah, and he was there two or three times. I ran into him, and a lot of people from California, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, all over the place. And it struck me that a good informed literate tour guide would be something that these people could use. And so when I first proposed the book to my publisher, Doris Winsell at Mayhaven, I had originally in mind a small book of about 125 or so pages. Mm-hmm. This book is 320 pages, has a fairly, I would say, extensive bibliography and extensive index, as well as 40 photographs. What happened is that I began to realize that to do the job I wanted to do, we needed some cultural background, some social background, and names of plants, names of trees, names of rivers. It's a real Illinois book. And, mm-hmm. and what I was trying to do is to put Lincoln in the environment that he actually inhabited.
Mm-hmm. Well, just so our listeners know, you have several books that you've published. You've not only published the Lincoln Poems, 2008, you have a stalwart called Living with Lincoln, which was published when?
1989. My very first book.
And the Alligator Inventions.
Right.
That is about?
It's a book of poetry. It's about Louisiana.
Okay. And then When the Waters Recede, it's about the Great Flood of?
1993.
Mm-hmm. So,
except it took me almost 6 years to get the book written. So,
right.
Because I kept visiting communities that had been flooded out and gradually were rebuilt.
Right.
It's a beautiful story.
So you are a prolific author. This book that you've written, I'm so glad that you did decide to expand it. The first half of it focused on culture and environment and people in place, actual who's who. And
right. There is a who's who chapter.
Is just fascinating, written like someone who knows how to compose a good sentence, or may even written some poetry before. Just very well written, very beautiful.
And well, thank you, Don.
Second half must have been your original proposal, where you just went through the various cities.
Well, it was more what I had in mind originally, but it was all written anew for this book.
Okay. So the original idea was to go to Springfield, mm-hmm. and Beardstown and Salem.
Yeah, all the counties of the old Eighth Circuit.
21 cities,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And you visited each and every one of them?
Absolutely. Wow. Some of them many, many times. Springfield in particular.
Well, you say at the beginning that you have written about 200 storyboards, Lincoln storyboards.
Yes.
On sites outside of Springfield that I gather became largely the basis of this book?
Well, it certainly inspired me because, I talk to people here in Urbana and so forth, watching and seeing the results of how much people cared about Lincoln. And each community had their own Lincoln story to tell and their own connection with Lincoln, sometimes humorous, sometimes tragic, but always adding just another little nuance to our understanding of the language of Lincoln. And I just thought there's so much going on that if nothing else, this would help people tap into all of those storyboards, which are now all over, you know, central Illinois.
For those who don't know what a storyboard is, just describe it.
Well, it's basically a rectangular metallic structure about 6 feet long, and each one contains some text about Lincoln in that on that particular site, and a photograph. Or it could be a photograph of a document, a letter or something, but it usually is a photograph of a building or something that stood on the site. And also the storyboards also have a raised rubbing. And this was a not-for-profit called the Looking for Lincoln, which through federal grant money was able to finance the whole project. And then while this was going on, Senator Durbin pushed through Congress the designation of this whole area, so it is now called the Abraham Lincoln National Historic Area.
Yeah, somewhere in your book you describe this as this great open-air museum.
Yes, absolutely.
At some point, I know you've got a auditory book, is that right?
Audio book.
On your Lincoln poems, it occurred to me to ask, you say you've been to Gettysburg. Uh-huh. They have the audio tour.
Right.
Is that a little too touristy for you?
Well, we have talked
about
doing an audio of this book as well. And mm-hmm. I think it won't be as narrowly configured. I know what you're talking about where you visit a site and there's a specific part of the tape that goes. But we may well be doing an audio of this book as well.
Really?
Yeah.
So if someone wanted to drive.
Yes, they could absolutely do that.
They could take your book and switch it on when they show up in New Salem, switch it off, and then drive down the road to Beardstown.
Or jam some CDs.
So you've thought about
that.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Well, I remember in your book you
it's meant to be user-friendly, but as I said,
that it
literate
is.
As well.
That it is. It's very intriguing. You mentioned the tourist and when you went to the see the Elgin Marbles in London.
Yes,
you were
yes.
Put off by the mechanical nature of that tourist. I think you have got the right idea about being a tourist. It should be less of an escape and more of a discovery.
Right, and
that's really what your book is about. Right?
And I've been lucky to meet some tourists and make some good friends in the process who help teach me how to be a tourist. It's not something that you do automatically.
Yeah. So are there no other cultural guides to Central Illinois and the Lincoln sites?
Not quite like this one, and I'm not saying that to pat myself on the back. I think there are some books that follow. There's a book about following in Lincoln's footsteps and so forth, but those are really more on the nature of logs. You know, this is where he mm-hmm. was that day, this is where he was the next day, and so forth. And, of course, there are some very excellent books on the ecological and geological history.
Sure. The prairie especially.
And, of course, it seems like new books, I've bought three in the last year, new books coming out on Illinois wildflowers and birds all the time.
Mm-hmm. Back to newcomers to Illinois, I was a newcomer and felt that certain, how did you describe it?
Agoraphobia
about the flat spaces, although I think I was a little bit more used to it because I knew the flatness of Texas, central Texas. Uh-huh. But so many people have spoken about that. And you have said that, to use your words, you have written this as a, quote, love letter to the prairie and the people of central Illinois, and your ambition is to get people to fall in love. With the prairie.
Yeah.
How do you achieve that?
Well, I think it's probably by looking at it with the eyes of an outsider or somebody who's seeing it, you know, from a different perspective. I remember I had been living in Illinois for a few years, and a good friend of ours from New Orleans came up to visit, And we took her out to the site of the Lincoln Homestead Park, where the Lincoln Cabin stood on the banks of the Sangamon River. It was during the fall, and harvest was going on and so forth, and we had a picnic out there. And she was very quiet, and finally I said, "Well, what do you think of all this?" And she says, "It's really beautiful." And she meant it. And I thought, you know, I've been looking at all this and maybe looking at it historically and not appreciating it. And sometimes it's hard to do that when we're right there.
Right. Some people see it as bleak, but when you look a full 360 degrees at a night sky out in the country, you have a different perspective.
Recently, I happened to be involved in a little poetry reading that the Dead Poets Society did in front of the Lincoln Tomb. It was the first week of May, and it was a beautiful, beautiful spring day. And a friend of mine took a photograph of me and some other people in front of the bust of Lincoln, and I sent it to a friend of mine who has family here and actually had attended Millikan, and himself a poet, and he lives in Santa Fe, and there was the lawn all around Lincoln's tomb, and everything was brilliantly green, and he wrote back, "It's so green, I had forgotten how green Illinois is."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that...
Lush.
Lush. And even, I've told people this lots of times, I've gone to England quite a few times, and I'm always, when I go to England, I'm looking on the horizon for one of those red barns.
Yeah.
And, of course, they're not there.
Right. Have to interrupt our conversation here. We have a notice from the National Weather Service in Lincoln. We have a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 9 p.m. Central Daylight Time for the following Illinois counties in the WILL broadcast area: Coles, Douglas, Edgar, Effingham, Moultrie. Again, we have a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 9 p.m. for Coles, Douglas, Edgar, Effingham, and Moultrie. All right, just to remind our listeners, we have a very distinguished professor of English with us today on Keeping the Faith, Professor Dan Guillory, who is a professor of emeritus at Millikan University, who's written a book entitled People in Places in the Land of Lincoln. And if you'd like to call in to ask a question of Professor Guillory or make a comment, you can call our local number, 333-9455. We also have an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Well, you also say earlier in your book that when your projects on Lincoln came to an end, you said, I think your words were, a profound feeling of emptiness since Lincoln had become a tangible presence in your life.
And that's true.
How well did you – I had a friend who was a Dante scholar. Dante's far more removed than Lincoln from our lives. But he said he felt he got to know Dante very – very well, very intimately. I think he felt he knew the man. How well do you think you got to know Lincoln, which is one of the great debates about Lincoln scholarship, just who this ambiguous, obtuse, strange, wonderful, inspiring character was?
All of those words apply. I think even Billy Herndon, who probably saw him more than anyone else, he was his law partner. Lincoln insisted on keeping the law office open. He said, "Don't take our shingle down," when he went to Washington. His biggest law case, which came out of a recommendation from Henry C. Whitney right here in Urbana, recommended him to the Illinois Central Railway. And Lincoln, of course, won a very important decision for them, so they didn't have to pay a lot of tax along the right of way, which would have cost them millions of dollars.
Of course, you said he had to fight for his $5,000 fee.
They wouldn't give him his money. Lincoln had to wind up suing them. And he, of course, once he got the money, he split it right down the middle with Billy Herndon, because he said Billy had done a lot of the research.
And of course, that was $2,500 would be a lot of money.
That was an incredible amount of money in those days. And, you know, I think that Billy Herndon said he never really got to know him, even though he wound up writing, wound up writing a Bible. I think he was inscrutable in a lot of ways. I do have there are a couple of things that I admire about Lincoln, not because They're unique, but because they do set him apart. Lincoln didn't drink, and it wasn't because he didn't. He thought there was something wrong with drinking, but because he felt it would cause him to lose control. But this set him apart very much from his peers. He didn't chew tobacco, which everybody did at this time. All the men did it.
The manly thing.
And it wasn't just this finely cut Copenhagen stuff that people do today. We're talking about big leaves and stems, and they would spit this stuff out all over the place and miss the spittoons, if there were spittoons in the vicinity. And, of course, they'd walk on this. And Charles Dickens, when he visited the United States, just thought this was barbaric. Lincoln didn't do that. Lincoln didn't own a firearm, didn't believe in shooting animals. And the other thing, and this is perhaps the most difficult to kind of put together in one piece, is that Lincoln, although he knew the King James inside out and quoted from it frequently, did not ever become part of a congregation and did not believe in the divinity of Christ or the Trinity. So you could
You say he was more like a deist than
more like a deist. But in the last months of his life, and I think this is reflected very much in the second inaugural, Lincoln attended a number of sermons at the Presbyterian Church closest to the White House, and he became fascinated with the notion of providence. And also, I think because he was searching.
He used the term in several of his speeches.
Yes, absolutely. It comes in, and there are more biblical echoes in Lincoln's writing than in any other president's.
Do you think he became fatalistic?
I think he picked up some fatalism from his Baptist parents.
And his
the poetry that he loved was deeply
Burns and Shakespeare.
And there were a couple of Scottish poets who wrote a little poem on mortality that he loved, a poem called The Last Leaf. I think he certainly did have some fatalism, but I think he also believed that there had to be some purpose to all this. So I think towards the end, he's not so much not a pure deist, but I think he does see some providential hand at work. And of course, he died before that all got worked out in his head.
Was he an exceptionalist, American exceptionalist? Did he think that there was something unique about the American experiment?
I would say absolutely.
Yeah.
Because this is another thing that some people don't understand. They think that some people say he made a religion of the Constitution. Okay, so he did. But he was so powerfully in love with the Federalist Papers, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. He took the Declaration of Independence literally. This is Stephen Douglas was always telling him, all men are created equal is in the Declaration of Independence, Lincoln. It's not in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And Lincoln said, no, this is law of the land as far as he was concerned.
That's interesting. Deism, by the way, is you might want to describe that for people who don't know. It was the religion of Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin. Probably George Washington.
Probably George Washington and most of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And it's not atheism, which some people think, but simply...
Yeah, he was challenged to confirm whether or not he was an atheist, right?
Yes. The Methodist preacher, Peter Cartwright, ran against him in 1847 for the seat in Congress and called him an atheist. And Lincoln actually published a broadside defending himself. And funny story, Cartwright asked people in his congregation, Lincoln was there that day, all the people that thought they were going to heaven to stand up, and then all the people thought they were going to hell to stand up. Lincoln didn't stand up for either one. And Cartwright says, Mr. Lincoln, where are you going? And he says, I'm going to Washington. And that's a pretty good example of Lincoln's humor. But the deism essentially believed that there was certainly a God, and that they took the order in the universe as a model for that. It's sometimes called God as the great watchmaker or clockmaker, but it's not a personal God.
God is not here among us. He's transcendent and other, right?
Just the opposite of what John Wesley was doing, for example.
So many people quote Lincoln and Washington as though he were like them in their religious traditions, and he probably would hold his cards close to his chest even today, but he is not an evangelical by any means, right?
Even though, And I talk about that in both of these Lincoln books, my last two books. The two congregations nationwide that did the most to elect Lincoln, and there's copious proof for this, were the Methodists and the Presbyterians, particularly the Methodists.
And his reelection too, right?
And we could say flatly that in 1864, if the Methodists as a block had not supported Lincoln, he would not
have lost. How close was it? I can't forget.
It wasn't that close because Lincoln also, I think very shrewdly, allowed the soldiers to go home and vote, and they voted almost universally for him.
That's interesting. Well, we're here to talk about your wonderful book, and I'd like to get a little bit into some of the physicality, the environmental quality of that you very beautifully described. You mentioned Professor James Hirt.
Yes.
In a book of his, Writing Illinois, in which he says that...
A beautiful book.
Most early 19th century visitors to central Illinois, that there was no comparable landform that matched the prairie. How much different was the prairie to what a visitor might go out when they see the flatland today?
Yeah, I think it was scale as much as anything, because they're just, particularly if you were coming from England, and we just seemed to be blessed with a whole bunch of people who came from England, and they were all good draftsmen and memoirists, and they kept journals, they made sketches, but when they hit that prairie, and they just did never see anything like it. I mean, it was bigger, and of course
360 degree,
yeah,
and they you just don't see that in England.
You don't have a place for it, and the same would be true in France. Prairie is a French word, but it really means something closer to meadow.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing like our sense of prairie. The other thing I think, too, was the prairie grass, the big blue stem, which I talk a lot about in the
mm-hmm,
book.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an extraordinary grass. In fact, ecologists distinguish between the tall grass prairie and the short grass prairie. And we, of course, had a little bit of both. But the tall grass prairie was again, a unique form. And in those days, it was so tall that one of the commentators said he had ridden by horse from the village of Chicago to Springfield, and the grass, he was on horseback, and the grass towered still over his head.
Yeah.
The profusion of wildflowers, too. A lot of people
the tall
about
stuff
that.
Is what? Horseweed and what else?
Blue stem.
The really tall stuff,
yeah,
above
yeah,
your head.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could get lost in it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, of course, we think... even when I talk about roads in the early part here, the roads were for most part old Native American trails or animal trails.
Traces, I think.
Yeah. Traces, the word they loved, and it's very, very appropriate. The Edwards Trace and so forth.
One of your chapter title was Gardens of the Desert.
Yes.
Where did that term come from?
William Cullen Bryant wrote a poem in the 1830s called The Prairies. It was widely disseminated, and I think it had a lot to do with people coming to Illinois. And he said, these are the gardens of the desert for which mm-hmm. the English tongue has no name.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really captured it. He was enchanted by it. He came to visit a brother in Jacksonville, and they went horseback riding along the Illinois River, and he winds up writing poetry about it. And he's not right. The first person who responds to Illinois with a book of poetry.
I think we should probably read again. We do have a notice from the National Weather Service in Lincoln. We have a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 9 p.m. this evening for the following Illinois counties in the WLL broadcast area: Coles, Douglas, Edgar, Effingham, Moultrie. Again, we have a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 9 p.m. for Coles, Douglas, Edgar, Effingham, and Moultrie counties in Illinois. Once again, we are talking with Professor Dan Guillory, Professor of Emeritus in English, who's published a book on the, I think it's fair to shorthand description, as a cultural guide for literate and curious tourists. for the Central Illinois sites associated with the life of Abraham Lincoln. And the title of the book is People and Places in the Land of Lincoln. And if you'd like to call in to ask a question of Professor Guillory about his book or his comments on the show today, you can call in locally, 333-9455. There's also an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. By the way, I forgot to mention to you, Professor James Hirt just died.
Oh, no, I did not know that.
Just passed away.
I did not know that.
The obituary is in the paper. Don't know the details for those of you who are interested. He's a very beloved professor here at University of Illinois.
Well, he's...
did you know him personally?
I didn't know him that well, but we've met many times. He's mentioned some of my work and some of his talks, and I had just the highest admiration for him.
Right. You say at the Lincoln Bicentennial you heard President Obama?
Yes.
He spoke there?
Yes.
And I assume he spoke in some greater detail about his own connection to Lincoln, which many people find very intriguing.
Actually, he didn't say it was. Didn't? It was very brief because there was a banquet that evening, and we all thought it would go on and on. But the president, there were several dignitaries who spoke, but including Michael Burlingame, the famous biographer of Lincoln, who's now at UIS in Springfield, but. He spoke very briefly. The thing that I was touched by about Obama that evening is, and remember, his presidency had just begun about a month before this all happened. And it was his first weekend outside of Washington. Mm. And I've told several people, I think he looked really relieved to be back in Illinois. It was my first impression. And the second thing was that he went around the audience. There were lots of people from Springfield there. And he went around shaking hands, and you could hear him say, "Oh, I remember you." And he was obviously talking to people.
Well, he just spent the past, 6 years?
Exactly. Right. He had been in Springfield as a legislator. And to him, this was sort of a homecoming. So it had a very kind of family-like feeling to it.
Interesting. Well,
it took almost 3 hours to get into the building. We were stopped by... Our bus was searched. Secret Service stopped us 4 different times. Mm-hmm. It was extraordinary security.
Mm-hmm. You did not talk about that train trip that Lincoln took on his inauguration to Washington that Obama and Biden took. I didn't see that anywhere in the book. What did you think of Obama and Biden's use of that as metaphor for?
Oh,
connecting
yeah.
Obama to yeah. Lincoln.
I think probably there are a number of connections there. I mean, I sometimes think that a friend of mine just told sent a little note to. I think sometimes people make too much of the Lincoln Obama connection. But I will tell you one thing that I think is the real connection between the two, and it's characterological. Their personalities, one aspect of their personality. A lot of people recently, myself included, have been a little impatient with the president because they would have liked to see more dramatic action.
Doesn't get all upset.
Yeah, mm-hmm. he's very calm.
No drama Obama.
Absolutely. And they mistakenly assume that, oh, well, he must not be that committed. I'm thinking particularly of the oil spill in the Gulf. And Lincoln, you know, Lincoln would have understood that completely. Mm-hmm. He I think the two are very cerebral. They like to think out a problem. They want to feel that they understand all aspects of it before they get in. But here's the other side of this. When they do think they know what they're doing, they strike like a cobra. I'm talking here, of course, of General Petraeus and General McChrystal.
And General McClellan.
Yeah, and General McClellan. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's what came to my mind there, that here was really the other – everyone thought, oh, well, Lincoln, he'll just put up with McClellan's. As he used to say, Lincoln said that McClellan had a bad case of the slows, which could be, I guess, applied to our situation in Afghanistan too.
Not everyone knows the story of McClellan at the beginning of the war.
But General McClellan was much beloved by his troops. He was known as Little Mac, and had before the war he was president of the Illinois Central Railroad. So he and Lincoln had sort of crossed paths before, and he was an outstanding organizer, but he kept telling Lincoln that he didn't have enough troops and that Lee could outman him and outgun him. And finally, Lincoln said, there's no way that he can have that, you know, why don't you just attack? And, of course, the Antietam was the closest McClellan came, and it's the single bloody, it still remains the single bloodiest day in American military history. But after that, Lincoln relieved him of command and a succession of generals until finally he got General Grant. And when everybody, this was after Grant won at Vicksburg, and everyone said to him, this is another great story, why do you want Grant? Don't you know he's a drunk or he's an alcoholic, he has problems with drinking? And Lincoln said, I want you to find out what he drinks and send a case of that to all my other generals.
Puff on what he's puffing on.
Yeah.
Right? Well, back to the prairie. One of the things that struck me in your earlier chapters, your first seven chapters, was this sense of rapid change from
Absolutely.
The 30s on to the onset of the war. We talk about change today.
Yes.
There was really amazing change. John
Deere
split the prairie and with his new steel plow and all the other. A marvelous short little chapter, which I think was delightful. What do you call it? Panics, clocks, and photographs.
Uh-huh.
Describe the sense of change that someone would have been experiencing.
Well, the panics had to do with that's what they called, what we call a depression today. And I like the word panic better because it I think communicates our terror. I speak as someone who got hurt in the stock market as so many other people did. But 1837, there was an incredibly devastating economic reversal. It nearly sank the state of Illinois, and these happened with some frequency during the whole period. So that was one kind of upsetting thing. The other one was the change that came about because of the railroads and railroad schedules, because suddenly everyone had, for the first time in human history, people had to agree to a common schedule.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This had not happened before. And we don't think, and the Illinois farmer suddenly became much more of a 20th or 21st century person than a 19th century person, because he had to think about markets, he had to think about fluctuating prices, currencies, even international markets.
As you said, all revolved around the new thinking about time.
Absolutely. And even people visiting relatives. But the photograph comes in and I think is so popular. And please understand that at this time, very few people could get their photograph taken. Lincoln understood the power of the photograph. He's the most photographed public figure in this period. We have about 103 photographs of Lincoln. But most of the photographs were formal, posed, usually husband and wife. You don't see candid shots of, kids with a slingshot in the backyard or something like that. That doesn't – you have to wait until the turn of the century and even closer to World War I before you start seeing candid, what we think of as the – but what came in – by that time, of course, we had Eastman's Kodak. In this period, we have traveling photographers, Altshuler here in Urbana, people setting up and sometimes only staying for a couple of months. And they would basically – take photographs of the available market and then move on. But that's how we got a lot of – Lincoln was photographed in just about every town he visited, including Decatur.
Good little story about Samuel Altshuler.
Yeah.
Apparently it was just – I think you said his studio was just west of the Urbana Courthouse, and he gave – he was short and stocky.
Yes, that's a wonderful story.
Yeah, tell that story.
Well, he – he had a apparently Lincoln's coat was too shabby for the purpose of the photograph, and so Samuel, the gentleman that he was, gives Lincoln his coat. But of course, with Lincoln's and Lincoln had outsized arms. His arms were by any standard they were too long.
It was a rail splitter.
Yeah, absolutely. And he could hold an axe out on the end of his hand. That was one of the little. He could still do that when he was president.
Really,
very very strong upper musculature, very strong. In any event, he agrees the coat was not too baggy because Lincoln, of course, was lanky and slender. But but the sleeves were too short. So Altschuler solved the problem by just sort of shooting him from the shoulders up.
Mm-hmm. So he couldn't see the tight buttons.
Right.
And the,
yeah, and the short shortened the sleeves. Although the everyone says that Lincoln's pants were always about 4 inches too short. So.
Yeah. Well, back to the prairie. You make the comment that the area of central Illinois is the richest land on earth. That it's not uncommon to produce 170 bushels or more of corn. Is that still true?
Yes. Yeah, I think
and
that's
as
it.
The agricultural centers around the world
well,
develop?
You know, I mean, I think certainly Brazil is giving us a run for our money. And you know, in the city of Decatur, where I worked for many years in the 1970s, it lost its crown as soybean capital of the world to Brazil. But I think, you know, assuming we still have the rainforest standing, I would stand by my statement. But, of course, you know, as that landform changes so much, 20 years from now, that may not be entirely true. But we'll still be one of the richest, if not the richest. And I think the other thing, too, is that the soil itself, I would say, if you look at how long people have been farming here, we were just blessed with incredible combination of events to make the hard pan soil, as they call it, of central Illinois.
Had a long time to develop its richness.
Absolutely.
We have a caller.
Very good.
On line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question or comment for Professor Guillory.
Yeah, hello.
Hello. You're from Urbana?
Urbana.
Yes, sir.
Mordecai Lincoln, the president's uncle, do you know much about him? I've kind of studied him in the sort of genealogical line. Read a bit about him.
Yes, I do know a little bit about him, but he's really more important for the early years of Lincoln's life, you know, and for his I think providing kind of the connection with the earlier part of the family. The family, of course, had roots going all the way back to New England, Pennsylvania, and of course Virginia, and I think a lot of you know, Lincoln's knowledge of the early years of his father, the attack by an Indian and so forth, those all sort of became part of the family narrative. And everything that I read about that period indicates to me that Lincoln held Mordecai in very, 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 very high regard, probably much higher than he held his own father.
Are you familiar with Mordecai being married into the Mudd family and the sort of the Maryland Catholic colony in Kentucky, so that Mordecai was kind of an active Catholic?
I have heard about that. I don't know much about it. I won't try to tell you that I do.
Well, it's another interesting untold story of Illinois, I guess.
Yeah, and you know, there's so many offshoots. I mean, for example, if you go out into the Fountain Green area, the western area of Illinois, you'll find that there is another Abraham Lincoln, who's a distant cousin, who was alive the same time as Lincoln.
Yeah, that causes problems in my genealogy. So
I'll bet it does. And when I was working for, we were talking about looking for Lincoln and the storyboards earlier. And when I started reading the storyboards from that area and they were talking about Abraham Lincoln, I thought, that can't be right. He couldn't have been there at this time. Then finally, you know, I started doing my double checking and realized, sure enough, it's the other Lincoln they're talking about.
Have you actually been to Fountain Green?
By it. I haven't actually been in it.
It's been turned into like an automobile graveyard. Someone's running a
junkyard there. Now, that I didn't know. I didn't know about that.
Something that probably ought to be, you know, preserved.
Well, it's been a while since I was there. I didn't know that. That's sad to hear.
Well,
it's a little unusual because so many of the cemeteries, I think one of the things that's remarkable to me about central Illinois is how much sort of we were talking about open-air histories going on around us all the time. I mean, local groups are either erecting statues or, you know, conducting cemetery walks. I mean, it's – and so many people are historical reenactors and spend a lot of time studying an area or boning up on it. But I am sorry to hear that about Fountain Green.
Well, I suppose I'll hang up and listen.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Thank you for your comment. Back to Lincoln's not we have a – there we go. You say Lincoln did not drink. And you mentioned when you brought that up in the book that he wanted to be, quote, the supremely rational man. Is that an Enlightenment European ideal similar to what Jefferson had in mind, or is there something else going on?
I think it's at least that. It's certainly that, or that's the background of it. But I think it also has something to do with Lincoln himself. I think he had a terrible fear of failing and had seen what he thought of failure in the career of his father, because his father, although a superb craftsman, Thomas Lincoln could build a beautiful desk or cupboard, what the English would call a joiner. He could put things together beautifully. He never raised a crop large enough to carry the family beyond the next season. Didn't sell any surplus, and so it just was a poor dirt farmer in the language of the day.
Later used Lincoln to make money.
Yes, and of course tried to borrow money from him. Lincoln did not invite him to his wedding, and Thomas Lincoln was never invited to the home in Springfield, and Lincoln did not attend his father's funeral.
Mm.
So there's a real estrangement. Also, Thomas rented Lincoln out when he was a boy.
Right, as a rail splitter and other
hog butcherer.
Yeah,
all the dirty jobs.
Yeah,
and never shared any of the money with.
I notice in your chapter entitled "Who's Who," which is a wonderful aspect of your book. If anybody's interested, it gives you a sense of important people in Lincoln's life, and I noticed that his father's not on that list.
Yeah, his father's not on that list.
But he was significantly influential.
Yeah. Well, it really was an attempt to I was trying, nor is Dennis Johnson and a few other people, that I was really trying to deal with pretty much the professional people that Lincoln interacted with and the people in New Salem, as opposed to those that were kind of, I don't want to say family baggage, but
who's who in his business and political life.
Right. Mm-hmm. But there's no question. Michael Burlingame, in his new biography, talks a lot about the relationship of father and son. And he says, for what this is worth, and I tend to think he's right, that Lincoln may well have had a kind of surly language with his toward his father and had a big mouth, and we know that Thomas Lincoln slapped him around. So I think my own theory is Lincoln did grow up to some extent as an abused kid. He was very smart. He liked to read. Thomas was always criticizing him for learning how to write and read books, and so there was constant tension between the two.
His mother died when he was 9, is that right?
Yeah.
And then his first love, presumably, and
I think she was his first love.
Herndon?
Rutledge.
Rutledge, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Anne Rutledge. She was, I think you said, 22?
Yeah.
Apparently that threw him for quite a loop.
Some people say that, well, he still, you know, carried on some business and so forth, so maybe it wasn't quite a loop, but, you know, he was profoundly shaken by it. There's all sorts of evidence for this now. In fact, I started doing the Lincoln poems and this book largely because of some of this new research on Anne Rutledge. Mm-hmm. I started out thinking I was going to do something on them, and it just grew from that point. But they were planning to, attend Illinois College together. Lincoln lent her his grammar book, which doesn't sound like perhaps a romantic thing. But this was an extraordinary gesture on his part.
Knowing how much you said he gave it to her.
Yeah,
he said he lent it.
Yeah,
lent it to her.
And it has her name. He wrote on the top of the book, "Annie is learning her grammar." Her death was just shook him down to the foundations.
Now, there's some people have written about this, and you have too, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. There's Professor John Simon has written a great deal about this and kind of did a landmark article in the beginning of the 90s about this, and that kind of changed. But, you know, there's a whole tradition that this was just blown up and so forth. But that came because of Mary Lincoln and Robert Lincoln, who didn't want any discussion of Anne Rutledge. So when Herndon came out with it, and it was Herndon who broke the story,
you mentioned that,
they really came down hard on him.
Right. We just have a few more minutes with Professor Dan Guillory. He's talking about his new book, People in Places. Get the subtitle right, In the Land of Lincoln. If you'd like to call in, we just have about 10 minutes or 8 minutes left, 333-9455, or you can call 1-800-222-9455. Well, you say in your book that the Lincoln of 47 to 57, that he was a profoundly different human being.
Yes.
Describe that a little bit.
There's one date. Well, say in 47, he goes to Washington and you know, gets discouraged with national politics.
As a congressman.
As a congressman, separated from his family and so forth, was opposed to the Mexican-American War, took a lot of heat and criticism for his objections to that, both in Washington and at home, did not run for re-election, came back home and realized he needed to make some money and he had a family to raise, and pretty much stays out of politics until the year 1854 when the Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed. And, of course, that was penned by his adversary, Stephen A. Douglas. And Lincoln gives, of course, his famous Peoria speech. He gives us the same version
Not everybody knows what the act.
The Kansas-Nebraska Act. I'm sorry. Essentially, allowed slavery into the new territories by saying that people, when they applied for statehood in Kansas or Nebraska, could just indicate if they wanted slavery or not. And Lincoln said, "No, that's not what the Constitution intended." And although Lincoln would not go against the Constitution, and that's why he didn't want to pass the Emancipation Proclamation at first. He said, "I do not want to see it extended, mm-hmm. even you know, one inch beyond." So that, of course, and then, of course, shortly after that, the Whig Party falls apart. Lincoln helps to found the Republican Party, certainly in the state of Illinois.
Decatur, right?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely, 1856. And by 1857, he is becoming a nationally known politician.
The Kansas-Nebraska Act.
And these are the territories, not just the states. It's a big area we're talking about.
It hadn't been split off.
Yeah.
You list that as one of the primary stimuli that led to the Civil War.
Absolutely.
Harper's Ferry being one, and I forget what the other one.
Most people would probably throw Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many other things. I mean, we could have had the Civil War as early as the 1830s.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was constant friction going on.
Well, Lincoln in his later days, at the end of that decade, was a much older man. You say it in the photographs. I'm wondering, I wanted to ask earlier, but we're out of time really almost to talk about this, his experience with death. Many scholars have spoken about from the time his mother died through Ann Rutledge.
Well, in between those two, his sister died. And it was a needless death.
Mm-hmm.
And Lincoln took that very hard as well.
And then his brother, his son, Willie?
His son, Willie. Willie was the darling of the family, a really cute kid. Everybody loved Willie. And he was handsome. He wrote poetry. He was smart.
Lincoln's favorite, right?
Absolutely. And Mary's, too. I mean, you couldn't describe him as a mama's boy or a papa's boy. He was both.
Mm.
And Mary never recovered. And for about a year afterwards, Abraham would go into his bedroom every Thursday afternoon. He would not see people, and he would just mourn for Willie.
Mm-hmm. And you had a poignant passage in your book where you describe Willie in the White House and Abraham and Mary would go visit dead soldiers.
Yes.
Piled up in almost every government facility in Washington.
And soldiers who were, you know, moribund or are badly, badly wounded. Mary wrote letters. This is a side of Mary that doesn't get enough attention. I think mm-hmm. we all know that she had a bad temper and so forth, but she also was very compassionate. Getting back to that change in Lincoln, I would say that word compassion, which I personally, in my own ethical hierarchy, and I know the Dalai Lama says this, and We certainly know it's certainly part of the New Testament. But I say, to me, the person who can show great compassion is a truly great person. Mm-hmm. And this is what happens to Lincoln. And that's why Reconstruction is so bad, because had Lincoln lived, it would have been a different America, mm-hmm. not just for the South, but for the North as well, because we both suffered from the tragedy of Reconstruction for decades.
That's interesting. Everyone always touches on this question that you brought up in your book about his attitude toward slavery, and I think your words were awkward and ambiguous.
Well, when he was a young legislator in 1837, he does come out against slavery, makes a statement against slavery in Illinois. But there were slaves in Illinois. Most people don't like to admit this. They were
a lot of people don't realize that.
Yeah, you know, they were brought in as indentured servants or whatever. But there were slaves in Illinois. I mean, it wasn't widespread, of course. And Lincoln, on the whole, did take cases to try to help people who were here as slaves to get their freedom. He got involved in a case in Mattoon, the Mattson case, that unfortunately he wound up on the wrong side and was very embarrassed, and he just didn't speak much during the trial.
You have a wonderful litany of those cases. I wish we had more time to talk about. We're getting close to the end here, and I wonder if you couldn't just take a minute to read your poem that you often read at the end of your talks on Lincoln.
Well, this is about imagines Lincoln speaking from the tomb.
We have just about 60 seconds.
Okay, and I'll just read a little bit of that. Here I am, the sentinel of Oak Ridge, watching the comings and goings, savoring the passage of time, which is like snow, redesigning the contours of the land, a soft tattoo like prairie showers on cedar shakes in that other world I once so happily inhabited.
Professor Dan Guillory, thank you so much. We've been talking to Professor Dan Guillory.
Thank you.
People and Places in the Land of Lincoln. Enjoyed your visit. It was very stimulating.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you for being here. You've been listening to Keeping the Faith. I'm Don Nolan, signing off until next week. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.